it's that most wonderful time of the, yes, day, we couldn't possibly wait a whole year, when we get to talk to Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, the food maverick, the food master.
I don't know.
All right, whatever. Anyway.
Exactly.
Hi, Arthur.
Whatever is the operative word here. I have done a lot of things in my life.
True.
So one of the things I did a long... Actually, I have to go look this up. Let's start with Joan Nathan. You know who Joan is?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good. Most Jewish people know who Joan Nathan is. She is our number one Jewish food writer. Meaning she is Jewish, but she writes about Jewish food. She is profiled this very week in the New Yorker magazine. And I think Hannah Greenfield, who did the interview and story, got her wrong. I have to meet Hannah one of these days. Somebody told me this week she lives within a short walk of where I live. So we need to get together. Hannah got her wrong because Joan is going to be remembered not as a person who wrote a lot of recipes, or who was a Jewish Julia Child, which is pretty much what Hannah called her, but as somebody who did, I think, very, very worthy work as a researcher and chronicler of food in the Jewish diaspora, meaning Jewish food all over the world. And I didn't know this. Joan wrote, about, I guess it's got to be at least 30 years ago, a book called Jewish Food in America. And I didn't know the story behind it, even though I know Joan very well for over 40 years, is that Joan wanted to write a book about the world diaspora of Jews. But Claudia Roden, another great food writer, who lives in England but was born in Egypt, actually, they shared an editor, Judith Jones at Knopf, and at that time it was about to be released. I have to look at the actual date. It was Claudia Roden's book on Jewish food all over the world. So Judith Jones said to Joan, instead of writing about food all over the world, why don't you just do the Jewish food in America? Now, certainly, Jewish immigrants from wherever they came from, but in those days mostly, and still, people came from Eastern Europe or Europe in general. We also have a nice little contingent of South Africans. But there were very few. In Brooklyn, we had a big Sephardic community, but there weren't that many in America, and people associated Jewish food with Eastern European Jewish food, as I did, because that's what I grew up eating. Anyway, Joan wrote a very important book going all over the country and seeing what had happened to the Eastern European food we all shared when it came to America. Joan, as I just said, was just featured in the New Yorker magazine, and it's apropos of her memoirs, which were just published this week. I'm in there somewhere. I haven't read the book yet, but I know I'm in there somewhere because we have had a lot of experiences together, and Joan did call me to refresh her memory, as she would say, about certain things. We went to the Soviet Union together in either 1988 or 1987. I have a jacket that we all got for this trip, a little windbreaker thing. Hardly get my arm in it these days, not my size anymore. But I'm pretty sure it says 1988 on the front. I got to go look because Joan thinks it's 1987. But we've had these little memory, you know, the song from Gigi, I Remember It Well. That's Joan and me. Oh, yes, this is what happened. Well, I remember it different. So anyway, this is Joan's moment. And the other day, Joan was interviewed by my friend Roseanne Gold at the Eldridge Street Synagogue. Do you know about the Eldridge Street Synagogue?
Yeah, didn't you do something there?
Well, I was, yes.
Okay, there you go.
Roseanne interviewed me.
Right.
And Leah Koenig, who's a new young Jewish food writer, This time it was she interviewed Joan Nathan and a man named Jake Cohen. Jake, who, I don't know, maybe he's 30-something, is like up-and-coming Jewish. And he wrote a book called Jew-ish. Please, don't tell me, oh, George Santos said he was Jew-ish. George Santos stole that line from Jake Cohen. Jake Cohen is a TikTok sensation. He has, I don't know, I think Roseanne said he had 1.5 million followers on TikTok. He's a very engaging, entertaining guy, and he makes very interesting food. I would say influenced by his Jewish background, but hardly traditional. And at the end of this interview at the Eldridge Street Synagogue, both Joan and Jake were asked what recipe they might be remembered by. I thought that was interesting that Roseanne asked that. Joan, for sure, said her matzo balls, which she seasons with fresh ginger and grated nutmeg. Something new to me, but actually not so new to Joan, because her mother, who, by the way, died at age 103, I said to Joan, because I knew her mother years ago, I said, what did she die of? She said, she had enough. That's 103. But anyway, she was a German lady, and she seasoned her matzo balls with grated nutmeg and powdered ginger, a big spice in my grandmother's pantry, actually, powdered ginger. Joan changed it to fresh ginger, which, of course, tastes much better. And those are her famous matzo balls. If you want to see Joan make her famous matzo balls, there is a video online. I'm sure you can find it, because I found it, and by accident, actually. The video I found by accident.
Is it YouTube?
It's Melissa Clark from the New York Times,
right,
making matzo balls with Joan. And Joan is not so much a video person, but I must say she's very natural on this, and it's really the real deal, so to speak. And Melissa Clark, even though she's a skinny redhead, is in fact Jewish from Brooklyn, so she knows from matzo balls. Between you and me and everybody who's listening, I don't like Joan's matzo balls. It's not the ginger and the nutmeg that throws me.
Yeah, all right. So by the way, they did this just after your birthday in 2012.
Well, so that's, 12 years ago? It doesn't matter.
March 27th,
the matzo balls haven't changed the iota.
But the ginger...
Joan may have aged
like,
a little bit. Melissa, I don't know, because I see Melissa in person. She lives in my neighborhood. And Melissa looks the same, too. I've aged. So if you want to see me, and the matzo ball video is there. In case you're interested, go watch Joan Nathan make matzo balls. Jake Cohn thought that he would be remembered by his brisket, but then he went on to say he always makes it different, so I'm not sure which brisket he's talking about. Now we're at brisket, which is what I don't know if I'm going to be remembered for brisket. I hope not, actually. But you can see me making the best brisket I ever cooked with Martha Stewart online. There is a video of the program I did with Martha. I don't know how many years ago that was, but it was a while ago. And on this appearance on her then TV show, we made a whole brisket the way I still make it when I make it. Not making it much these days. But anyway, we'll get to the whole brisket deal in a minute.
Are you going to make
brisket? And also this Passover apple cake, which at the time that I was on Martha's show with it was a new recipe to me. And you can get the apple cake recipe on the Martha Stewart whatever website. I found it easy. Just put in Martha Stewart, Arthur Schwartz, and you'll find both the brisket, the video of me and Martha making this brisket, and also a video of me and Martha making this Passover apple cake, which started out, just to give a little history here, it started out as a bad apple cake. somebody brought it to me. I don't know, their mother made it, something like that. I don't even remember anymore. And it's probably in my computer somewhere, but I don't remember it anymore. But they brought me this apple cake, and I said, it's a little on the stodgy side. And then it dawned on me, by the way the cake was put together, this was originally a recipe for Passover, and it was not made with flour, but it was made with matzah cake meal, which you buy in the store. I mentioned on the Martha Stewart show that you could grind up your own cake meal, just take matzah meal and put it in the food processor, but I was wrong. You'd have to use a blender, I think, to get it fine enough. But anyway, it's like flour, but it's just ground up matzah meal. And they sell it, I'm sure, now a week out from Passover, I'm sure you can find it somewhere if you want to do this. Anyway, it's a nice apple cake. It's not an exciting apple cake, but it's kosher for Passover. And I have made it for a number of years now. Everybody loves it. It's better made the day before, which is always a great thing when you have a holiday dinner coming up. And by the way, so back to brisket for a minute. So brisket is also best made a day ahead. My big question in my life, and still don't have a really great definitive answer, is why do Jews make brisket for the big holidays, for Rosh Hashanah and for Passover? Those are the two big feasting holidays.
Don't you think that...
Go ahead.
Don't you think that that's just because it serves a lot of... It's a nice haunch that serves a lot of people?
That's one reason, but why brisket? I mean, brisket, it's become sort of universal. Why not a standing rib roast?
It
can serve a lot of people too. By the way, let's start with the kosher cuts of meat all come from the forequarter. Hindquarter meats are not kosher, not in the U.S., by the way. In Israel, I understand, I haven't been in Israel in many years, you can get hindquarter meat because there almost everybody wants kosher or koshered meat. And the big problem with the hindquarter is the sciatica. Tell me about this. I have sciatica. The sciatica nerve runs through the hindquarter. Anyway, forequarter cuts are kosher, which is why, by the way, a rib roast is in fact the most precious piece of beef. Because it is forequarter and it is tender. But it's very, very expensive. Now, brisket has become very, very expensive. I mean, brisket is a main meat of barbecue. In Texas, they love brisket. Brisket has become very popular outside of Eastern European Jewish communities. And so the price is in demand, price goes up. What they sell, I mean, the same thing with corned beef, by the way. Corned beef is made from brisket. It's brined brisket. Pastrami is not made, or should not be made from brisket. Unfortunately, mostly it is these days, because the plate beef, which is a much fat, it's like bacon, is much fattier than the brisket. Americans don't really want it. I do.
When you make brisket, or when you buy brisket, don't you try to get the plate? We always try to get the plate.
Well, that's not plate. That's deckel. That's the top, the second cut, the point. They
right.
Have different names. I see it as point in my supermarket. And I try to grab the whole brisket. Yeah.
Okay.
So, in fact, go online and see this piece of meat that I made with Martha Stewart. It wasn't my cooking because, in fact, I didn't cook it. It was her staff that cooked it. But they cooked it according to my direction. My recipe, which is in, by the way, Jewish Home Cooking. I've written extensively about brisket and how to make it. I make a non-tomato brisket. Jake Cohn talked about tomato brisket and not tomato brisket. I make a not tomato brisket. But my grandmother Rosie, my father's mother, she made a tomato brisket, which I loved. But she didn't, she always called it Yankee pot roast, which is really what it was, with ketchup.
Oh, my God.
That was the tomato product.
Was the ketchup at that point not sweet?
No, it's
always been sweet, right?
I think it's been the same. You'd have to ask the Heinz people. I don't know. It was. Let me just tell you that Heinz ketchup was the very first commercial product that carried the OU, meaning that it was certified kosher. And they made, in fact, it was Heinz and the Orthodox Union, OU, that together came up with this idea to put an OU on the label to indicate kosher, but not to scream it, not to trumpet it to the non-Jews who might be afraid to eat it if they thought it was kosher. We're talking in 1926, I think this was. It was in the 20s that Heinz came out with kosher Heinz ketchup. And hence, by the way, Jews started using the ketchup in all kinds of crazy ways. Like, I grew up with friends who used to eat spaghetti with ketchup. We lived with Italians, so we knew better.
Right.
Anyway, back to the brisket. So, yes, the brisket has two pieces. The first piece, the flat piece, the main piece, is called first cut, which gives you the impression that it's better than the other piece, but I don't think it is. The other piece is called point cut, second cut, deckel in Yiddish, which means actually cap or top. I guess it would be called the brisket cap or top. Anyway, that part is much coarser grained and much fattier, but if you cook it all together, then there is a layer of fat between the point cap and on top of that. And if you don't trim that off, which butchers always want to do because Americans want lean meat, if you cook it all together, you'll end up with a much more succulent pot roast than if you don't cook it all together. And I add very, very little to this. And I don't sear the meat. If I was making just a flat cut, and it was extremely well trimmed, as most are, I might sear it in the pan, in a roasting pan first. But otherwise, I would just put a layer of sliced onion on the bottom. How much? At least half the weight of the brisket itself. So if you've got a 6-pound brisket, you want 3 pounds of onion sliced on the bottom of a big roasting pan. I like to put a few sliced up, like one or two carrots at the most, sliced on the bottom. I put a couple of bay leaves, and I salt, pepper, and rub in some crushed garlic into the surface of the meat. Put the meat on top of the onions, cover it with foil, and in a 300-degree oven, it's going to take minimum 3 hours, maybe 4 hours, and you want to take the meat out when it's still ever so slightly firm. Let it cool. This is what my mother always did, and it was very clever, I thought. She took the meat out after it's cooled down. She took the meat out from the onions, which, by the way, no liquid. The onions and the meat itself produce a lot of liquid. Take the meat out. Cut off the top part, the fatty part. Trim it down. And slice the meat as for serving slices, meaning, I don't know, half inch thick, not quite, third inch thick. And as it's still conformed in the shape of the roast, put it back in the pan. And that would be refrigerated, it is refrigerated, overnight, so that the next morning you can pull off all the rendered fat, which is hard fat, and reheat the roast without any covering on it. It'll get nice and brown on the top, 350-degree oven, and heat it through. Don't overcook it. You've cooked it ever so slightly less than it really needed to begin with. And not only do you have beautiful slices, but really succulent meat, which finished its cooking in its own juices with the onion. Now, if you want to make a gravy out of that, go ahead. When it wasn't Passover and you could eat grains, we would have the onions with the juices over kasha, not even kasha varnish, it's not kasha with pasta in it, but just plain old kasha. I love it, especially with the onions from the roast. But you could, in fact, run it all through a food mill and get like an onion thickened gravy out of it. But I don't know, just Jew and you know, I mean, the juices and the onions to me.
The easy, I have to. Okay, so
go ahead.
Okay, salt and pepper. so much less evolved. Let's just say, salt, pepper, onion powder, garlic powder.
Well, my problem is those powders, you know.
Well, whatever. Like, but I'm just saying. Yeah. Back in the, this is grandma, okay?
Oh, all right. Grandma used. We went through many phases with my mother.
Oh yeah. So I'm just doing grandma, which
okay.
Because
grandma,
I've always
yeah.
said my mother was an indifferent cook, but her brisket anyway. So da 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 da, and yes, we evolved out of garlic. It was actually garlic powder, onion powder. Slice the onions, put them on the top, and pour, it was Hunt's tomato sauce, and then one can,
yeah.
a small can of Hunt's tomato sauce over everything, and then one can, and then stick that in the oven at 300, and until it was an hour before, peeled potatoes an hour before you thought it was going to be easy.
Yes, I love potatoes cooked in there.
Right. So
they need a good hour.
Oh, easy, yeah. And no one ever calculated properly. But, you know, then it's the fork moment where it's like, okay, this is done. And you really have to not rush it because by then you're hungry. But just wait. And then...
I'm getting hungry.
She'd pull it out, rest it, and then slice it. But there was a bunch of gravy that wasn't fatty, and uh-huh. if it wasn't Passover, whatever. You know, one of the treats along with the potatoes was bread and gravy. And I got to tell you, that
can't
was...
Can't have bread on Passover.
I said when it wasn't Passover.
Oh, I didn't hear that. Sorry.
Come on. I mean, I know the rules. I'm not necessarily... You know.
We can break them, even though we know them.
I'm just talking about brisket. But what I'm saying is the thing was so good that it became, this is to your other question, it was the, not the, it was the night before the big dinner. Like the night before the wedding. It was a celebratory.
Celebratory, yeah.
And I'm just talking so basic because you had essentially a one roaster meal, and then salad for those of us who can't be without greens, yay me! But and then what was left, if there was anything left, would be assaulted, starting early in the morning. Because the second day it was either brisket sandwiches or reheated with the gravy or just a panoply of
Well, I don't know. It got me thinking. Will I be remembered by any particular recipe? I don't know. If I had to choose, like which recipe would I want to be remembered by? I probably would say potato kugel. I do make a masterful potato kugel, and that is what we ate on Passover because you're allowed potato kugel, but you're not allowed noodle kugel. Anyway, but mashed potatoes are a great accompaniment to this, of course.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
The only problem is, my great mashed potatoes contain butter and milk.
Well, you
and
need
that,
butter
and
milk.
You can't do that if you're kosher.
These are just regular. They're not roasted because they're peeled and they're not. They cook.
No, cooked in with the meat.
Yeah.
I have to say, I will admit here, my mother was a pretty good cook, even though she didn't like cooking very much, and she did take shortcuts. Remember, she was a 50s housewife, and she succumbed to 50s mentality about this, and she would open up, I don't even know if they make these anymore, canned, they called them Irish potatoes, and they were canned potatoes.
Yeah. My mother used to eat those out of the can.
Well, I can't see doing that.
Neither can I.
But I understand it's a possibility.
They must have had a ton of salt or something in it.
I don't know. They have a very particular taste.
I know.
And I actually should go look for them in the supermarket to see if they still have it.
I was just horrified always. So.
No, I know. But once you cook them with meat, which is what my mother... My mother did not eat them out of the can. But it was the potato that she chose to put in when she was making a meatloaf or a pot roast.
Hmm.
They were very good to throw around a meatloaf.
Right.
And as I said, they had a very particular taste. I should go see if they're even made anymore. I don't think they are, actually.
Huh.
But who knows? Irish potato, I didn't even understand what that was until many, many years later. I mean, really, not that long ago. I was teaching cooking to homeless women who were housed at a Henry Street settlement housing for homeless women and their families.
Right.
So all these women had at least one or two kids living with them. Anyway, I don't remember exactly what we were cooking. Oh, I know.
I remember I was
making something with sweet potatoes, and one of the women said, I only eat sweet potatoes. I don't eat Irish potatoes. I said, I don't even know what Irish potatoes were. It ends up in some places, any white potato is called an Irish potato.
Huh.
Go know.
Yeah, really. I had no idea about that.
You live and learn, as they say, you know.
Precisely. But the other thing is, you know, on my palate, sweet potato doesn't go with everything.
Since I live with somebody, I will not mention the name, who absolutely refuses to even try a sweet potato, I rarely make sweet potatoes, but I'm often tempted. One of my favorite, and I don't need him to eat them, but I do love a roasted sweet potato.
Oh, yeah.
That is then reheated in the microwave. They taste like candy.
That's true. Or roasted sweet.
Microwaving an already baked sweet potato.
I ruined the microwave at the radio station because I used to make sweet potatoes for the dogs.
Your dogs eat sweet potato?
Huh?
Your dogs like sweet potato?
If you need a carb that if you need a carb, then yes, sweet potatoes is a good one for dogs.
I think sweet potatoes are a good carb.
But unfortunately, I
who or what you are
timer on and been gone to do a show with Marshall, and neither one of us realized what was going on until there was just us. Horrible smell of burning. So there went that microwave, and there went
anyway,
that plan. But
Passover
normally,
is coming,
you know,
and if you are observant,
wrong button. Because
if you are observant, you are already preparing for Passover, and that includes in my day, we lived in the same house as my grandmother, who was very observant about Passover. Anyway, and all our Passover pots were in the basement. And she got to a point where she didn't want to schlep all these pots upstairs and all the everyday pots
right.
downstairs. So it became my job. So and then there were dishes and I have to laugh about this this Passover. But my downstairs neighbor, not all that long ago, convinced her frugal husband into letting her renovate the kitchen that they've been living in for 40 years already or more. So she renovated because she has to make Passover, and she has children and grandchildren. So that's a lot of Passover pots and pans and dishes. We live in an apartment house. There's no basement to store. Well, there is, but anyway. So she convinced him that she should redo the kitchen only because she has this Passover obligation. Well, now that they have a redone kitchen, they go to a hotel for Passover.
That's what happens.
Much, too much to cook for this big family. You know, you get older, you think it's not so terrible to have somebody else cook for you.
Right, all of those things. Once the kids are a certain age and there's just lots of...
Yeah, when the kids are 40 and over.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know what, we're going out.
You can stop cooking for them. They know you can do it.
Thank you very much, Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, Robin Hood Radio.